Welcome to episode 155 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. The Sentientism worldview answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Michael Housekeller. Michael is head of the philosophy department at the University of Liverpool. His current work spans transhumanism, death, and meaning. He's written on a vast range of topics, including on whether non-human animals can have meaningful lives and what is it like to be a bot. He says of his work, "As a philosopher, I'm a generalist, which is a nice way of saying I've done many different things and I'm not really an expert on anything in particular. I beg to differ." I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 154 others. Why not let me know via a review, rating, or comment? Check out our back catalogue too if you just found us. Every person who subscribes, likes, rates, reviews, or shares an episode with a friend helps to nudge the world towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates, or just search for sentientism, that's sentient with an ism on the end, on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made very welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Good morning, Jamie. I'm very well. Thank you.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join this series of sentientist conversations. And we have a few interesting little connections already. So you've co-authored a paper with one of my previous guests, Brian Earp.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, we've both been guests on the 3CR podcast, Freedom of Species, although I think your appearance was quite a while ago. And then we had a few conversations around your fascinating book project you're working on at the moment about subjective meaning and obviously, those questions of what meaning are and the meaning of life and ethics are central to this series of conversations. But it's a series of conversations about what I think of as the two deepest philosophical questions, what's real and what and who matters, the questions of epistemology and ethics. And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to develop and popularize this really broad pluralistic worldview called sentientism, which suggests that when we're thinking about epistemology, we should take a broadly naturalistic approach that uses evidence and reason to try and work out what's true and what's real. And when it comes to moral scope, the clue is in the name that all sentient beings should warrant serious moral consideration. But I'm lucky in these conversations to talk to a dazzling array of people, some of whom agree and some of whom don't. So it'd be great to understand your own sort of philosophical stance and your journey on those questions. But before we get into those questions, how would you best introduce yourself and your work for people who don't know you?
Okay, so I'm Michael Housekeller. I'm German, but I've been living in England for 20 years now, more than 20 years now. So I feel very much like a British philosopher rather than a German or continental philosopher. I used to be and teach at the University of Exeter for 15 years, for 5 years now, I have been at the University of Liverpool. And what do I do? I suppose that most people would see me as an ethicist, but in a very broad sense, because I'm not very much interested in figuring out what is right and wrong, permissible and impermissible, and why that is. I'm more interested in broader questions about what it means to be human and what it means to live a good life and a meaningful life. And I've been working for many years, I've been working on human enhancement and transhumanism and the ideas behind those movements concerning, again, the question, what it means to be human, because if you want to enhance people, then you need to have some conception of what it would mean to be a better human, because that is what human enhancement is about. And if you have a conception of what would constitute a better human, you need to have some idea what it means to be a good human, and that requires to have some understanding of what it means to be human. So it all hangs together there, and that's what got me interested in the enhancement debate. So I've been working on this for many years, but by now, I think I've said everything that I can possibly say about this. And for a few years now, I've shifted my focus towards meaning in life more directly, especially in connection to death or mortality. So in what sense and to what extent does the fact that we have to die and that we know that we have to die affect our ability to live a meaningful life?
Yeah, that's a fascinating range of work. And one of the things I like about your work as a complete amateur outside the field is how much of it focuses on these deep foundational questions rather than, you know, getting lost maybe in some abstruse corner. They seem quite foundational questions to me, and I think they're the most important ones, hence my bias in these questions.
I like that too, but the problem with that is that it's very difficult to be precise. You tend to lose yourself in rather vague or at least imprecise attempts to grasp something that is extremely difficult to grasp, right? And because it's so broad, it makes it so much harder to come to valid conclusions about anything, you know?
Yeah, that can be a challenge.
I'm very much always in the questioning mode and searching mode. I hardly ever feel that now I've got it, now I know what's what, now I have the answer, right? I usually have questions and more questions, and I never get to the final answer, an answer that actually satisfies me about everything, you know.
That's a disappointment, because I was expecting you to tell us what the meaning of life really is. But
I'm in the habit of disappointing everyone.
Well, I love that. I love that questioning attitude. So, let's start digging into some of those deep questions. And the first one I like to ask is, what's real? The question of epistemology, I guess, and how should we go about believing? And for many of my guests, that's a story about whether they grew up originally in maybe quite a naturalistic, scientifically minded household that was maybe more agnostic or atheistic, or a context that was maybe more supernatural or mystical or religious in some sense, and how that side of their changing about they're thinking about what's real and how we should go about believing might have changed through their life, if it has. So you can tell that you can wind the clock back as far as you like to sort of tell the story and explain where you are now on that big question.
I don't know. I mean, obviously, this is one of the very, very broad questions. What is real? I don't even know how to answer that in a general way. It's much easier to point at something and then discuss whether that is real. And obviously, I mean, if you can point at something, if you can name something, then in some sense, it must be real. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to talk about it. But then to capture the reality of it, to capture what it is actually we are talking about, that is a problem. Now about my background. Well, I was raised a Christian. I was sent to Sunday school and Bible classes, and I was made to confess regularly to the village priest. And I guess I sort of believed that there was a God when I was little. It was mostly because my mother insisted on there being a God who's watching, not over me, but watching me. God sees everything, she used to tell me. And that was clearly, as I figured out later, a means of controlling me, just to make sure that I don't do anything naughty or forbidden while she's not there.
Yeah, so God is a sort of imagine remote surveillance device for your mother.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Big brother in the sky, or big brother in heaven. And I remember distinctly how I was feeling this presence. I mean, not feeling, believing that there really is someone there who's checking on me. And, very quickly, I dropped my religious beliefs, if there were beliefs in the first place. I mean, you're not really able to think about stuff. So is that really a belief? So as soon as I started to think for myself, I became an atheist, basically. So I don't have any concrete religious beliefs.
Yeah. And as a child, did that sense of a presence, did that feel oppressive or reassuring or a mix of the two? Or do you
oppressive.
Remember what that
was just oppressive.
Yeah.
I felt it reassuring.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't, again, I didn't feel the presence. I just believed that there was something because I was told there was something. But the something that I thought was there was a punishing God, critical God, someone who makes sure that I did nothing wrong. So the feeling of it was certainly oppressive. It was not reassuring.
Yeah. And what was the process like of moving away from that set of beliefs to becoming atheist? Because in the conversations I've had with people so far, some of them still are religious now, but most of them have started out with a religious worldview. I had one, you had one, and then have moved to something that is broadly naturalistic and often atheistic. And for some people, it was quite an easy journey. It just sort of was never really that important and it faded away. And for other people, it was psychologically really difficult, often socially really difficult, and in some cases actually presented even, physical risks to people as they shifted their worldview. What was the journey like for you? Was it hard or easy or something else?
No, it was easy. It wasn't dramatic at all. It just sort of faded away or dropped away gradually because it wasn't a strongly held belief. It always was superficial. So there wasn't a major change in my worldview. It's just that it became more and more unreal and unimportant, and then it dropped away. So I would describe myself as an atheist, although some people take me for a Christian because I might share some of the intuitions that religious believers have. So I'm not entirely comfortable with calling myself a naturalist, although I don't believe in anything supernatural either. But naturalism is also very programmatic and ideological, right? I would say with Hamlet that there are things in heaven and earth that cannot really be understood with our philosophy. So there's a lot of things in this world that we cannot understand and probably will never be able to understand. And some naturalists are very confident that we can understand everything and there's no mystery there. And I think there's a lot of mystery. For instance, I was teaching a class on transhumanism for many years. And one of the key texts that we looked at was an early paper by Max Moore, who was one of the founding people of the transhumanist movement. And the text was written in 1990, I think, and was just called Transhumanism Towards a Futurist Philosophy. And in that paper, he argues very much against any kind of religious worldview. So religion is a big enemy for him in that paper. Whereas transhumanism, the philosophy that he wants us to adopt, is based, according to him, alone on science and reason. And then he advocates a scientific world picture and says, things like science. There's nothing basically that science cannot tell us. What science has figured out, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of consciousness, and what we haven't understood yet, we will understand in future. And I always, when I read this passage, always go, well, hold on a second. How have we figured that out? So what exactly is the origin of the universe? Right? Big Bang, is that the origin of the universe? How does it answer anything? Right? Or the nature of consciousness. We are far from figuring out what consciousness is, let alone how it could have emerged from what seems to be inanimate matter. And life as well, we haven't understood how from non-living material suddenly, at some stage in the history of the universe, living things emerge. We don't know. Now, is it possible for science to figure some of those things out? I don't know. Might happen, right? But it might not. I can't imagine that anyone will ever figure out the origin of the universe, because for that you would have to step out of the universe, meaning step out of everything, which is not possible. But there's some chance that we might figure out how life emerged from non-life, perhaps also consciousness. I'm not very confident that will happen, but I cannot exclude the possibility that science might figure it out. But my point here is, some naturalists are extremely confident that science can answer all questions, and I don't have that confidence.
Makes sense. Yeah, thank you. So in the sort of ontological space, you don't have any supernatural beliefs. So I guess you're a naturalist in that sense, that you believe that the natural world exhausts sort of reality. They just,
yeah, whatever there is natural.
So yeah, exactly.
I don't know what there is.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things that I don't understand, and a lot of things I don't know anything about. But whatever there is part of nature.
Right? Yeah, that makes sense. And then when we come to the epistemology, which I guess is more the method, how do we go about forming beliefs and credences? I like the way you describe that too, because I share that worry that some naturalists go down a route that some describe as scientistic, where the formal scientific method is the only way of understanding things, and also combine that with a sort of human arrogance that everything is understandable and we will definitely get through, it's just a matter of time, and there's sort of lack of humility in there, and that can also sometimes feel quite cold and clinical, in that it implies maybe there isn't space for intuition or emotion or feeling. And I'm not really a big fan of that approach, because I think it can lead us astray. But I guess what I try to do is think about naturalism in a much broader sense. And that's partly why in the definition of sentientism, I use the terms evidence and reason rather than science narrowly, because I think of those things in a very broad way. I think there's all sorts of different types of evidence, including our own personal experiences, that we should accord some degree of credence to. We should be skeptical of our own experience, of course, like every source of evidence, but it is a type of evidence too. So it's quite broad in the sense of what types of evidence we should bear in mind. And that can include a broad sense of reasoning too, that can include, you know, emotionally driven thinking and intuition. And again, we should be skeptical of those things and look for clarity and look for coherence and look for consistency. But let's not make the methods too clinical and too narrow. And I also think that humility is deeply important. And ultimately, that's a central part of even a good scientific method, right? Is you're always supposed to be in doubt. You're never supposed to be 100% sure. You're always supposed to be open for new sources of evidence and new lines of reasoning. And there is a danger with some naturalists that they sort of feel like they've closed those options off because they're so confident that this randomized controlled trial they've done really is the final answer, that they've almost slipped into their own dogma. So I don't know if that means we can save naturalism by talking about it in a sort of more more humble, broad, generous sense. But that's the way I tend to think of naturalism.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I'm completely agree with you there. What worries me or what annoys me very often is the confidence in certain approaches and certain views about the world, which relates to the question that you asked earlier, namely, what is real? There are certain conceptions of what is real and what is not. And those conceptions inform the way we look at the world and what we allow to be considered real. For instance, some naturalists might say consciousness, subjective experience, is not real. Right? What is real is the biological, physical processes underlying consciousness, and that actually is consciousness. So the objective, seemingly objective, is really real, while the subjective only appears to be real, which to me makes no sense, because you create an additional layer of reality where the reality that you actually experience, and I said earlier, if you can point to it, if you can name it, then it is real. We experience it. It is there. So it must be real in some way. So what sense does it make to say, well, that is not really real, something else is more real? And other philosophers have the idea that Plato, for instance, or Parmenides, that being is more real than becoming. So the really real doesn't change. Time is not real. What's really real is unchanging. But we live in a world of becoming. So how can the world of becoming in which we live, the only world that we really know, how can that not be real or less real than something else? But there's always this, or very often, this normative use of reality. So by calling something real, you declare something else to be unreal or less real. So I would say it's all real. Everything we can point to, everything we can name, everything we can think about, everything we can feel, and of course the thinking and the feeling itself, this is all real. It might be real in different ways, and it's a job for philosophers to try to figure out what those different ways of reality are, but reality is often used as a, a term to deny something else its reality. So it's when the question is asked, what is real? What we often mean is what is not real. And we want to sell a certain idea of what is not real by claiming that only such and such is real.
And I wonder how much of these patterns of thinking is sometimes a hangover from the supernatural and religious worldviews that most of us were brought up in, because it seems sometimes that there's this, an echo of a soul that people want to deny the existence of, that leads them to also deny consciousness, when it's actually possible to conceive of it in a completely naturalistic way without having to deny that there's something going on there. You can just, we're essentially using terms to describe a phenomenon that exists. Why do you have to separate it and put it into different pieces and then deny one of those pieces? And in the same way with the idea of the subjective, it's, to my mind, a subjective perspective is explicitly part of one objective reality that we all share. And I don't see why you have to make a sort of weird, deep distinction between the two. They are part of one integrated reality.
Exactly. But sometimes the distinction is also used to justify certain practices. I was thinking, for instance, of denying the reality of animal suffering, which was quite common, not so common anymore, but it was a very widespread idea that animals only appear to be suffering. We interpret their behavior and their screams or whatever as an expression of suffering, what in fact they don't. So it's a Cartesian model of the non-human animal,
yeah,
where the animal is just res extensa, and there's not really anything there. But the interesting thing for me is not, well, for one thing, that you can deny here something that seems so obvious. I mean, if you see an animal in pain, you know it is in pain. So it takes a lot of willful blindness not to acknowledge that the animal actually is in pain. And the other thing that I find interesting is that one of the reasons that was given for why it was not possible, why animals could not possibly feel any pain, was because it would then be far too horrible how we treat animals. So because what we do to animals would be not justifiable if they felt pain, it cannot possibly be true that they do feel pain. God wouldn't allow it, right? So we have this so-called supernatural perspective there. If we assume that the world is good and we see all the apparent suffering in the animal world, then it cannot be. Right? So there's a moral reason behind denying the suffering of animals.
And I think that's another brilliant example of how epistemology and ethics relate to each other. And simply speaking, I think bad epistemology and bad ethics can often feed off each other and motivate each other. And in the same sense that, and we'll get on to the ethical questions in a moment, that sense that, you know, animals surely can't feel pain because if they did, this would be a bad universe, but it can't be because God is good, is almost an echo of the humanistic psychology that works in the same way, which goes, I'm a good person, we're good people, therefore the things we do must be good, therefore animal farming must be ethical. So, and we'll come back onto that later on, but it seems again there's a sort of echo of a sort of a religious mode of thought that's then rebuilt in a more humanist mode of thought. And I think that partly drives the risk around the sort of scientific arrogance we were talking about before, because you've gone from maybe a religious worldview that reifies the human as being made in the image of a deity, and, you know, typically speaking, in many religions, therefore, the world and other animals and plants and so on are part of our dominion and therefore our purposes. But really, we're the point of the entire universe, you know, all 400 billion stars in the Milky Way and all however many hundred billion galaxies. The point of all of that is us, right? We are the point of it, which is a supremely arrogant start. But it does feel that's almost recreated in a scientific way of thinking, because that arrogance comes from this sense that we as humans are some sort of weird, distinctive being that has a unique rationality, which somehow is guaranteed to have a complete and perfect understanding of everything. When, of course, a genuine scientific understanding helps us understand that we're, you know, just another evolved animal. Who have no sort of birthright ability to understand everything at all. And, you know, I don't think we should draw boundaries around our knowledge and stop, right? The way to find out where those boundaries are to keep trying, but let's not be naive about us having some super privileged position in the universe, right? Science should teach us the opposite.
Exactly. If we have evolved naturally, as seems to be the case, then there's no reason to assume that our brains are capable of understanding the universe. Why would the creature have evolved that is capable of that? What possible use can it have? So a naturalistic perspective should actually teach us humility there, what you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think... you can see that, you know, our intuitions and even our intellect are really quite well honed for situations in which you know, we adapted to evolve for. But as you move further and further away of those, from those situations, you know, I'd argue our intuitions get, you know, less and less reliable. We need to be even more skeptical of the way we think. So let's leave that sort of what's real epistemological, ontological question there. But that's been a fascinating sort of exploration of how you think of things. I think it's a really broadly generous but humble naturalistic view that's also skeptical of a sort of narrow scientistic stance. But if we've already started to hint at some of the next questions about ethics, the questions of what matters and also who matters. And sometimes I separate those questions out and start by asking, okay, given the context you came from, where you started out with a religious worldview and you became an atheist, what context did that set for the grounding of your ethics, if you think there even is such a thing? You know, what do you think good and bad, right and wrong ethics and morality mean, and how has that changed through your life? You were brought up in a Christian context. Did that also set your ethical context about right and wrong and good and bad? And did you then, did your ethics shift as you moved away from Christianity, or were they your sort of orthogonal journeys?
I don't think that my early Christian upbringing has shaped my moral ideas and values. I think morally, I've been shaped probably mostly by watching certain TV shows like Lassie and The Waltons and Little House on the Prairie and things like that. Which I watched as a kid, and that taught me what it means to do something right or do something wrong, because it was all about people and animals being in certain relations to each other, and from how they interacted with each other, certain ideas of what is right and wrong emerged almost naturally, without the need to articulate any principles behind it. So my ethical views or moral views are probably very basic and simple. It's about being nice to each other, being decent, right? And decency and niceness are qualities that do not play a major role in ethical discussions, but I think they are foundational.
I can't agree more, and it's there's almost a sense of embarrassment about answering the question in such a simple way, but I think that's absolutely the foundation, because there, you know, there are ethical theories of, you know, egoism, certain varieties of egoism, or a relativistic stance, which is just more about, you know, groups coming up with rules together, or transactional models of ethics that are more about reciprocity and so on, or nihilistic ethics, where you sort of give up on the whole thing to some degree. But I think, and or even divine command theory, where ultimately, you know, good and bad are really defined in the context of obedience to a deity, or, you know, following somebody else's plan, or doing what you're told. But I think if we put those types of ethical systems aside, and I think we should, it does seem that the core of ethics is something to do with whether and how we care about others. And that feeds through into that. These are basic ideas of decency and kindness and consideration for others. I think that's a sort of pretty solid grounding for any ethical stance. And I'm not sure if there's an ethical stance that doesn't include any consideration for others, I'm not sure it's moral at all. It's just either amoral or maybe even immoral. Yeah, so I think we should be unashamed at that sort of common sense grounding.
Yeah, I agree. I find it very difficult to align myself with a particular ethical system and say I'm a utilitarian or I'm a Kantian. whatever some philosophers do like to say and some philosophers are. That's because it always seems to me that those systems highlight different aspects of morality, different moral considerations that are all important. And again, perhaps it links to what we said earlier about what is real and not real. If I'm a Kantian, then I basically declare utilitarian considerations for unreal or for irrelevant, right? What is real about morality is whatever the accordance with the law, or however you want to put it. And if you're utilitarian, you declare deontological considerations for irrelevant, and that means basically unreal. And it seems to me this is all real. This is all part of the moral net, which is not, it's not just one theory that from which morality springs. Morality is a lived experience which probably has many different sources, and those sources are our life, the way we encounter the world in which we live, and the way we encounter other people. And so that may well be the case that it's not always compatible. We have conflicting moral intuitions. And I think it's a wrong approach to say, well, if you have conflicting moral intuitions, one of them must be false. Because it assumes that our morality must be consistent and coherent. But I don't see why that should have to be the case if morality emerges naturally through life. You know what I mean? And that's why it's often so difficult to decide moral dilemmas where, I don't know, the typical philosophical scenarios, the ticking bomb scenarios, or the trolley case, that because there are different intuitions. And when philosophers try to tell you that there's one right answer, I'm always suspicious. There's no right answer. Some situations are really, really tricky, or whatever you do something wrong, you hurt someone, you harm someone. So to think that there must be a right answer somehow assumes that we can live a perfectly good life, that our actions can always be on the moral side. And sometimes we're just in a situation where whatever we do, we screw up, we do something bad. We have to act anyway. And perhaps that happens more often than we care to acknowledge.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm very sympathetic to that sort of really pluralistic approach. And this idea of focusing on sentience and sentientism is quite often associated strongly with the utilitarians, people like, you know, Peter Singer, and then an adaptive version of Richard Rider, and some of the people they built their work on. But it doesn't have to be utilitarian at all. You know, in a sense, you know, the sentience of a conscious being, you might describe that as an outcome. So in a very broad sense, maybe it's a sort of consequentialist thing. But as I've been working on this series and these ideas, it's been fascinating to explore, you know, completely different ethical systems that can still use sentience as the way you set your moral scope. So you can have a feminist care ethic that talks about care for other sentient beings. You can have a deontological approach that recognizes that all sentient beings can be ends in themselves, for example. You can take a virtue ethics where the virtues of kindness are extended to all sentient beings, as well as obviously the utilitarian approaches. So I really like the idea of being super pluralistic about all the different ways you might think about ethics. But as we'll come on to soon, right, it's really important that we get the moral scope right.
Yeah, in certain situations regarding animals, we can see that the utilitarian approach is insufficient, or at least it seems to me that way. The first book that I wrote in English after I came here 20 years ago was called Biotechnology and the Integrity of Life. And it was basically an attempt to figure out what the term integrity could mean, not as a character trait, but as a term that was at the time frequently applied to non-human animals in ethical contexts, as a kind of substitute term for dignity. So the reasoning was basically because it's weird to talk about dignity with animals, we use the term integrity instead. But then why was the term introduced? Well, because we can imagine situations where the elimination or reduction of suffering leads to ethically counterintuitive results. For instance, Bernard Rolin and others have suggested that we could reduce the suffering of animals, for instance, battery chickens, by genetically manipulating them in such a way that they suffer less from the circumstances which we force upon them. So rather than changing the external conditions in which we force them to live, we change them so they don't mind any longer to be in those conditions. And at the extreme end of this kind of reasoning is the suggestion that we could genetically create living beings that have lost the capacity to suffer at all. So then the question is, from a utilitarian point of view, what could possibly be wrong with that, right? We can still eat our chickens and we're not morally responsible because there's nothing there that has moral status anymore, because if sentience, the ability to suffer is all that matters, and we have a being that doesn't suffer, then we have no moral problem. But intuitively, there seems to be something wrong in creating a living being that isn't able to feel anything, right? Imagine we wanted to go back to slavery, human slavery. And of course, we can't do that because now we are enlightened and we know you shouldn't be doing that to other people. But then some clever scientists had the idea of creating humans that are incapable of suffering. We're having the discussion right now about robots, creating human-like robots that are perhaps conscious, but if we want to use them, and why would we create them if we didn't want to use them, then perhaps we should create them in such a way that they cannot suffer or not suffer from the way we want to use them. For instance, we want them to be slaves, and then they love being slaves, right? Again, from a utilitarian perspective, it seems to me that there cannot really be anything wrong with it, because no suffering results from it. On the contrary, we take away the suffering. So it's a good thing. But still, there seems to be something wrong with that. And you have two options here. You can either say, well, you're mistaken, there's nothing wrong with it, right? Because we're utilitarians and only suffering matters and there's nothing there. Or you say, well, there is something, which means that utilitarianism doesn't capture the whole of morality. And what is real and what is not real? This is real, and it's a real moral intuition, even though it's very difficult to put our finger onto it to get clarity about what kind of intuition it is and what it is grounded in. And that's what I tried at the time with the concept of integrity. But it's a word, right, that you use in order to capture a certain intuition. And perhaps in the hope that by giving the intuition a name, it becomes more real.
Yeah, thank you. And that's a beautiful exploration of, I think, not just a challenge to utilitarianism, but also you can hear a sentient being in the background. Luna was going a bit nuts because there's an alarm going off. Luna, what's up? I'm trying to talk here. We're talking about you in part.
Who's Luna? Sorry.
Luna is our, I call her a puppy, but she's actually 4 years old, but a little rescue dog behind me.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's not.
I've one here as well.
Yeah.
She's a bit older. She's 10 now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Pets as well, sitting on the sofa right over there. Watching me with interest.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Luna sometimes makes guest appearances, but now she's making an audio appearance. Apologies for you. But yeah, so I, as I was saying, that's really interesting because I think it is a challenge to a utilitarian way of thinking, but it's also a challenge to a sentientist scope and saying, look, maybe we, in some situations, we need to go further than that and look at ideas of integrity, or other people look at ideas like dignity, or, you know, telos or purpose or agency. There's some fascinating explorations. And the way I've tried to frame this sentientist start is to say, look, we can go beyond sentientism if we like, but what's most important to me isn't, you know, the risk of including beings or entities that we shouldn't be including. It's that we're excluding beings that should not be excluded. So I'm much more interested in making sure all the sentient beings get included than I am worried about whether we go further. So I'm quite open-minded about going further. But this question of, I guess the way I ask this question is who matters? Because I think many people would agree with the discussion we had about some sort of common sense grounding for morality being to do with how and whether we care about others. The problem comes when we talk about, okay, who counts as an other and who gets to warrant moral consideration. And that's another interesting journey that people go through their lives of thinking about, you know, as a child, family and friends, going out more broadly to think about humanity, but also that critical step of thinking seriously about non-human animal consideration too. So it'd be interesting to know your sort of journey in thinking about moral scope and the scope of moral consideration and how you've gone through that journey. And where are you now, given you're actually also challenging where the sentience goes far enough?
Yeah, I fear that I will probably be a great disappointment to you. I was a vegetarian for 20 years, started when I was, I think, 20. And that was because I read Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, and I was very convinced that Singer was right. I didn't want to participate in practices that cause so much animal suffering. So I became a vegetarian. I never was vegan. It wasn't really a thing at the time.
Yeah.
And also I like cheese too much, I suppose. So I was a vegetarian for 20 years, but then at some stage I stopped being a vegetarian. So I reverted to morality, at least in practice, that was smaller, narrower in scope than what it used to be.
Yeah, and that social attractor is a strong pull. It really is, right? But I would guess that while your practice changed, your theory hasn't, or did your theory change to match the practice? If that makes sense, do you still recognize that all sentient beings warrant moral consideration, or have you actually rethought the theory as your practice shifted?
I'm a bit reluctant to reconsider the theory just to match my behavior.
Yeah.
Because I very often get the impression that people's theories are very much influenced by what they want to be true.
Oh, yes.
held the theory that animal lives or animal suffering doesn't matter, then that would be, how should I say, a bit hypocritical, or would just serve my interest and help me to feel better about myself. I don't want to do that. I suppose, I mean, why did I stop? The cynical answer would be I got tired of being good. More reflective answer probably be that it takes, at least I felt at the time, it takes so much effort, certainly socially, constantly have to be alert, you constantly have to tell people, you constantly have to worry about this. Also we had small children at the time, and I didn't want to force them to be vegetarian, and it was difficult to make sure they had a vegetarian diet with others and so on. That's why I stopped. It became probably too inconvenient. But I still believe that obviously animals have moral status, and animal lives matter, and animal suffering matters. I guess I feel now more than I used to do that I won't be able to change the world, so I've arranged myself with the facts of life. And now I'm not saying it's not possible to live as a vegetarian. It's not possible for us all to live as vegetarians, but it's still a fact of life that we cannot live without killing. And even if we didn't eat meat in order to protect crops and vegetables and everything, we would still have to kill those other animals who also want to eat the stuff that we want to eat. So it is utopian to think we could all live peacefully together without hurting each other. Now, that doesn't mean that you cannot reduce the suffering that you cause, and I don't really have a...
Yeah, it's not perfection or nothing, is it really? So, yeah.
Exactly. I don't really have a justification why I'm not doing that more than I'm currently doing.
Yeah, thank you. And I think it is difficult because all of us have dissonances between our theory and our practice, right? No one has got rid of cognitive dissonance completely. But I'd agree with you that I'm at least glad that people whose practice has maybe drifted away or doesn't line up, that they don't let that undermine their theory. Because I do get the sense that because the social default and the practical default is so strong, that as those difficulties lessen, as it becomes practically easier and socially easier and less inconvenient, that people will, and people find it easier to bring their practice back in line with their theory, it keeps that hope alive that we can, you know, at least systemically move in a more positive direction. But I find it fascinating because I've spoken to, you know, many philosophers on this topic, and it seems that there are some philosophers who, even moral philosophers, who think of their work in such an abstruse, disconnected academic sense, it almost doesn't feel like it has any emotional, motivational force on their choices, their lives, or even society. It's a purely academic exercise, and that certainly isn't, you know, your style at all. There's another group who just almost become drawn into being activist philosophers. So they lock into the ideas around moral scope in the human sphere, but particularly in the non-human animal sphere, and basically become activists as well as philosophers, because they're so engaged and so emotionally driven by the topic that they feel that force to put it in practice into their lives and to proselytize and to influence others as well. So there's that part. But I think the most common route is probably just based on a recognition that philosophers are, you know, also ordinary people who are strongly influenced by social defaults too. And many people, you know, I think on the street and philosophers end up in a position where, you know, their theory is in one place, but the practice is in a different place, largely because of those societal defaults. And then it's a question about how much, you know, whether you just acknowledge that or how much, or whether you then go into some post-rationalizations to try and justify it. But yeah, I find it sort of fascinating. But the Phil Papers surveys sort of shed a light on this idea that, you know, are moral philosophers more moral than the average person on the street? And I think the conclusion is that they're generally not, really.
No, they aren't.
But the theory gives me hope, right? If we can still have that theory as a North Star that we might be able to push ourselves and society back to, maybe that gives us something positive.
Might.
To aim
I mean, it's not completely unconnected. I mean, and it's not just a theory. It's a way of thinking about the world. And this does affect our practice, even though it doesn't translate in a straightforward way immediately into practice. There might be hurdles on the way, there might be distractions, there might be changes in the way it is translated, but it's not completely separate.
Yeah, thank you. And there's there's in a way a little interesting. I really don't want to get into sort of auditing my guests' personal choices at all, but it's a fascinating case study in a sense of how philosophy, in a sense, just isn't enough, right? Much of the core of the problems we'll talk about later when we're talking about making a better future are really about human psychology and social norms. You know, just getting the philosophy right often isn't the trickiest bit. But I am interested in exploring this idea of what matters and who matters in another way, which is how you think ethics and morality links to the idea of meaning and the meaning of life, because that's another space where you've done some fascinating thinking about, you know, having a meaningful life isn't just something that humans have, right? It's something that non-human animals and other sentient beings can have as well. So how do you think this idea of having a meaningful life relates to the ideas of ethics and morality, whether it's human or not human?
Yeah, I'm not sure how fascinating my work on this really is, but I should perhaps say, I mean, the stuff I'm currently working on, as you know, is an attempt to justify, defend a subjectivist conception of meaning in life, meaning that my position is that I don't think meaning is something objective, an objective quality of life, so an objective quality of the universe, something out there, but rather it is an aspect of experience. It is still very important, because if you don't experience your life as meaningful, then it's very difficult to experience your life as worth living. So that very much goes together. But I don't think lives can only be meaningful if they serve a higher purpose, for instance, or they connect to some objective values that are out there. The problem with many current philosophical theories of meaning in life is that they take guidance from certain paradigmatic cases of supposedly meaningful lives, which all famous people, people with great achievements like painters like Picasso, or scientists like Einstein, or humanitarians like Mother Teresa, and the people who did important things. And if that is the paradigm that you use in order to understand what a meaningful life looks like, then the result is that most lives seem meaningless, certainly compared to the lives of those people. And it seems to me that this is wrong. I think most people's lives are meaningful, their experiences meaningful. There are things in those lives that are very important for people, even though it might not be important from the perspective of the world or of society. They might just live their lives, and no one apart from their family and friends and the people they interact with takes any notice of it, and they will be completely forgotten once they're dead after a while. But that doesn't mean they don't live meaningful lives. And it's also not the case, again, based on my own intuition of what it means to live a meaningful life, that you have to do important things like doing philosophy or doing art or whatever, something that has a cultural value, is culturally appreciated. Many people just live ordinary lives, but that doesn't mean their lives are not meaningful, because there are things in those lives that they follow with interest, that are important to them, that they engage with. So that is where I'm coming from. So I'm trying to defend that idea of meaning being subjective in the sense of being a quality of our experience. But one other reason why I want to defend this is because I just don't get the notion of objective value. So the idea is that it's not enough that things matter to us in terms of meaning or in terms of morality. They must matter in themselves, objectively. But I don't know what that means. You know, I've never understood what that means. The vain notion of an objective value appears obscure to me. So it would require to say that even if I don't value it, it is valuable. It would also require that even if nobody values it, it is valuable. But I don't understand what it means to say that something is valuable if nobody values it. Surely the idea of a value that isn't realized by anyone is obscure. It's like Kant's thing in itself. We perhaps need to assume that our subjective values are grounded in something, but what that is completely obscure. So ultimately, things matter if they matter to someone.
Yeah. And the part of the reason I love that, I mean, I've only read the first couple of draft chapters of your work, which you were kind enough to share. But I guess there were two reasons why I really love the approach. One is because I do intuitively draw all value ultimately back to the quality, a momentary quality of sentient experiences, because I struggle to conceive of what value could be that ultimately doesn't draw back to that. So I can see there are all sorts of different instrumental values, but ultimately, if they don't ultimately impact the experiencing of a subject, I don't see what value even is in that context. But I also like the fact that it felt to me deeply compassionate, because rather than trying to judge the meaning of some other being's life, you're saying the judgment of that meaning is their own judgment of their own meaning in that subjective sense. And it felt like it's a deeply genuine attempt to, you know, recognize the value that another being feels in their own experience, rather than to try and impose that from outside. And in your paper, you know, your Living Like a Dog paper, you've taken that, you know, idea beyond humanity too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also has something to do with what you said earlier, namely the virtue of humility. William James wrote a wonderful essay, which was called On a Certain Blindness in Human Being, where he basically defends the idea that we have to assume that there's always more to the experience of someone that is different from ourselves than we can possibly understand, right? Because the other is the other, and they do certain things that we wouldn't do. And perhaps what they do is so different from what we would do and would want to do that we can't really understand what makes them do those things. But we need to assume, says James, because we have this blindness, so our understanding is based on a very narrow experience of the world, which is our own experience, and perhaps that of a few people who are near to us. But the more different the other is, the less easy it is for us to understand. And then we could just say, well, there's nothing there to understand. They're just crazy or just stupid. But the alternative is, well, we assume that there's something there. There's some point, and we try to understand it as best we can. And it seems to me the same is the case with animals. And it's not even that difficult to understand it. Many philosophers working in the area of meaning and life are convinced, or at least their theories clearly exclude animals from having meaningful lives, because it's a very anthropocentric perspective on meaning. You have to do things like art or philosophy in order to live a meaningful life, do things that are objectively valuable, not just eat and drink and sleep and whatever other animals also do. So what we share with animals basically is not what makes our lives meaningful. As Thad Matt said, what goes beyond the mere animal existence, that in us that surpasses the animal in us, that is what makes life meaningful. And it seems to me that to say that non-human animals do not have meaningful lives, that when we say that, we judge their lives as not worth living. Even though we might want to theoretically distinguish between a life that is meaningless and a life that is not worth living, as some philosophers do, in reality, we very much associate a meaningless life with a life not worth living, or at any rate, a life that has a very reduced value. So life that is meaningless is a life that is not worth living, and that is also a life that is not worth protecting, not worth any moral consideration. And if I look at animals, for instance, my dog, right, when I go with her to the park and see what she does, when she chases her ball or smells the fox and goes after the fox, whatever she does, there's interest there. She smells things that I cannot smell. So I can't understand the significance that those smells have for her. But clearly, again, going back to what we said earlier, you can see it. It's like denying the pain even though you can see the pain, other philosophers or other people deny the meaning, the experience of life as meaningful, even though you can see that clearly her life, the dog's life, is meaningful for her in the sense of being significant, having something that is perfectly enough to fill her life and make it worth living. She doesn't need anything more. And we have this idea that only human lives are truly worth living. Going back to transhumanism, another thing I wrote about is the transhumanist take on animal rights and how we should treat animals. And most transhumanists are probably utilitarians and also sentients. Did you also, I think you have one episode with David Pierce or?
Yeah, David was one of my earliest guests, yeah.
Okay, so David Pierce, one of the most prominent transhumanists, he is a negative utilitarian, an abolitionist, as he calls himself, because he wants to eradicate all suffering. And of course, it includes animals. And other transhumanists have suggested that when we enhance ourselves to more and more advanced levels and eventually become post-human, the gap between us, the quality, the goodness of our lives, and the quality of animal lives becomes larger and larger. So we leave them behind, as it were. And so we have a moral obligation to also uplift animals to a human status and beyond. Why? Because the life of an animal, a non-human animal, is bad because it is a life of an animal. So it's not because of the circumstances that it experiences or the circumstances that we force upon it, but even the best possible life for an animal, if it is protected from predators and whatever, it can do whatever it likes to do. Even that life is a bad life because the animal, as an animal, doesn't have any access to cultural goods. It cannot do politics, it cannot do philosophy, it cannot do art, and so on. So these objective goods, animals, because of their nature, miss out on. And that is deeply unfair to animals. And therefore, if we can, we should uplift them, meaning enhance them, so they also can think like a human. And that is so, for me, this is so weird because it assumes that our lives are the best lives. That is also in John Stuart Mill's famous quote about it being better to be an unhappy Socrates than a happy pig, right? What's wrong with happy pigs?
Absolutely.
We are not pigs. But pigs are pigs, and for a pig to be a happy pig is the best you can ever be. And it's not the case that the pig would be better off if it were a human. Humans are better off if they live like humans, but not pigs.
Yeah, right? I love that approach, and it seems so. The idea of a meaningful life links to the idea of whether a life is valuable, and the idea of whether a life is valuable links directly to the idea of whether they warrant moral consideration. In a sense, it's not a 100% link, but it does seem that that's quite a strong correlation. And as you say, if you the power of the anthropocentric assumption is so overwhelming in the human society and in philosophy that often it doesn't even need to be said, right? It's actually reasonably rare, I find, that people explicitly exclude non-human animals. most of the time they just don't mention them at all, on the simple assumption that humans are the only source of value, meaning, and warrant any moral consideration at all. But it's fascinating how you describe that, because what that does is, if you describe all non-human animal experiences and lives as devoid of meaning and value, and therefore the implication is those beings are not worthy of serious moral consideration, not only does it condemn all non-human animals, in a sense, to being disregarded, because once you're outside of moral consideration, anything goes, right? You can be harmed and killed with impunity, right? In a sense, in pure sense, just do not matter at all. You're also condemning most human experience. As you say, all of the human experience we share with non-human animals, by definition, is also therefore meaningless. So it's only the people who are writing symphonies, or, you know, starting businesses, or, you know, creating great art or science, that really matter. And the vast, you know, what I would probably argue is 97% of human experience is condemned in the same way as the non-human animals are as well. And it leads into, I think, a powerfully and dangerously elitist mode of thinking that has, I think, very serious impacts for how we think about meaning in the human context, let alone the non-human animals, because in a sense we're condemning much of human experience in the same breath as we are with non-human animal experience. And it feels like the transhumanist space is a fascinating movement to explore that in, because my sense is that much of it has followed that path, really, and that much of the transhumanist movement does feel like it's not just sort of forgotten about the non-human animals, or maybe wants to enhance them if we can be bothered, but is actually quite elitist in the human context as well, so that some transhumanists seem quite comfortable actually leaving most humans behind as a small group of elite enhance themselves and go on to create some sort of post-transhuman existence, and an almost a separation within the human species between the haves and the have-nots that can get quite unpleasantly elitist. But there are other schools of thought, and I think unfortunately they're fairly minor ones within transhumanism, and I think David Pearce is one of these, for whom his transhumanism, I think, is driven from a genuine and deep sentiocentric compassion. So, I mean, he's vegan himself, and he absolutely doesn't exclude non-human animals. And I think the only reason he's interested in changing non-human animals, for example, living in the wild and so on, is to mitigate their suffering. I don't think, and I may have gotten this wrong, but I don't think he sees that they're intrinsically bad and therefore need to be enhanced and transformed to something else. I think it's just a compassionate thing that says non-human animals suffer, and if there's a way we can help them, that would be good. But that's very different from the mainstream transhumanist approach you laid out.
I wouldn't say that is a mainstream. There are a few people like George Worski and James Hughes who have advocated the uplifting of animals. Perhaps David Pearce is more mainstream than Dvorsky and Hughes in that respect.
Okay.
But you said there's genuine compassion there, and that may well be, but again, what is being inferred, or what is being made of that compassion in that particular case? So David Pearce wants to abolish all suffering, including the suffering of non-human animals. And the way he wants to do that is by re-engineer animals in such a way that they can no longer suffer. Us as well, but also animals. So what I said earlier, we create beings that are incapable of suffering, because it's not just actual suffering that is bad, but the very ability to suffer needs to go. And second way of achieving the goal is to eradicate all predators. So all animals that constitutionally, by virtue of their nature, eat other animals or dependent on eating other animals, they have to go to get rid of them. So no tigers, no lions, just lambs and cows, nothing else. And so we have animals that we have a very reduced variety of animals, and they all are incapable of suffering. Now, again, one might say, well, what can possibly be good about the ability to suffer, right? Well, why do you want to hold on to the ability to suffer? Surely suffering is bad, then surely the ability to suffer is also bad. That is the reasoning behind it. It's a very straightforward utilitarian reasoning there. But again, there's this unease about it, right?
No one really likes to suffer,
but doesn't suffering also have a value, at least the ability to suffer? What gets lost if we cannot suffer anymore? For instance, I always think of love. What does it mean to love someone? If I cannot suffer when something bad happens to the one I love, or cannot suffer from the loss of the one that I love, if I'm indifferent to any bad things that happen to them or to their loss, how can I say I love them? So
yeah, isn't that part of the package? Isn't that sort of intrinsic to the meaning
of the package? So if you remove suffering, a lot of other things will also change. You cannot just isolate one thing and take it out and then believe that nothing else will be affected. It will all be affected. The way we are in this world, that we are with other people and other beings, would change completely. I'm struggling. What I said at the beginning, it's so difficult to say anything precise about these things and why it is wrong or what is. Even the word wrong seems wrong to me. It's just there's something there that might be lost, and we're trying to articulate it. But just because we cannot articulate it with sufficient clarity, it doesn't mean it isn't there or it's irrelevant or it's not real.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? And I wonder if because there's clearly some uncertainty and risk and danger with that sort of purist abolitionist stance, which says, look, let's re-engineer the biosphere to remove any negative valence at all. I mean, that's an extreme position, and I can understand a deep level of concern with that. But there's also a danger we go the other way into a sort of naturalistic fallacy where people will say, well, you know, predation is natural, wild animals suffer, you know, animals are bred in farms to be killed and eaten. You know, that's their telos, that's their purpose, you know, and there's a sort of natural stance that can lead us to, you know, ignore the suffering of some beings just because that's the way the world is, unfortunately. And in some circumstances can even lead to us reifying suffering in some bizarre situations, quite common in religious worldviews as well. And I don't think there is a easy answer, but for me the best navigation in a way comes back to the conversation we're having earlier on, which is genuinely trying to appreciate the perspective of the other beings and, you know, what do they want and what do they value and what's meaningful for them. And I think that's the sort of the only guiding light I can find to sort of make sure we don't go too far down either of these sort of dimensions of completely eradicating all suffering, or sort of just, you know, amorally accepting it because it's natural. That's my sense, is, you know, is that compassion as a guide, even though it won't give us easy answers all the time.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, there is a naturalistic fallacy. If you say just because it's natural, it's good and needs to stay the way it is. So I wouldn't want to say that myself. Just because it's natural, it's good. But in natural things, first of all, there's horror in what happens in nature, but there's also a lot of beauty. And predators are beautiful too, and that beauty should count for something. So I have this idea that Plotinus actually articulated that. He said that beauty is, I don't know how to translate that, beauty is a shine of the good. So it radiates, the good radiates out, and what we then perceive is beauty. So the beauty of the world is important. It is something that gives us an indication of what is worth protecting. Sorry, that is one thing, that beauty is important, and the predators of this world, of the animal world, are part of that beauty of the world. And the other is that it's again the opposite of humility to think not only that you can, as Voltaire said, tend to your garden, that is, tend to the things that you can control in your life within the framework of nature and within the framework of human life as one thing, and it's very different to think you can redesign the world, not just do certain things better, improve how things work in the world, but redesign it, right? Create a world in which no one suffers.
And we're good at hubris.
No predators, whatever.
Yeah.
Reinvent the world. And that there's no humility in there. But this is only an argument, of course, for those who think humility is a virtue. And some who pursue those goals would deny precisely that. John Harris explicitly says, when he discusses Michael Sandel's argument against enhancement, which is based on the giftedness of life, the idea of giftedness, he says humility is not a virtue. But for him, humility is not a virtue, right? You need to be proud and ambitious. And
yeah.
So being humble is not something we should aspire to. So it's a different worldview already there, which dictates the kind of things that we accept as virtues and as good and as desirable. And I don't think there is an overall referee that could actually make the ultimate decision on who is right and who is wrong. It's ultimately about us deciding who we want to be in what kind of world we want to live. And so it's about us making certain decisions and creating the kind of world, and also preserving the kind of world that we want to have.
Yeah, thank you. And I think humility is deeply important, as long as it doesn't become an excuse for inaction or withdrawing our compassion. Because, as you say, the other extreme is hubris, and we know us humans are great at misguided hubris, so let's not go there. I did want to respect your time, because I'm just about to run over, and I haven't even got around to asking the final question, which is, how can we make a better future? But you've answered so much of it already in talking about transhumanism and how we treat non-human animals and potential for even artificial intelligence and so on. Is there any other sort of observation you'd like to make about how you think about how we can make a better future, ideally for all sentient kind, beyond what we've talked about already?
My hope is, but it's a very slim hope, that somehow we become more caring and less ideological and less self-destructive. But I'm actually pretty disillusioned by now, through mostly political events of the past 10 years or so. I mean, what really shocked me was first the Brexit result, and that and the reasoning behind it, the willingness to commit economic suicide there, and the reasoning behind it, the anti-immigration impulse, which was very strong there. And then, of course,
and to my mind, it was another, and again, you know, don't get too much into politics here, but it was another classic case study of how poor epistemology and poor ethics can feed off each other and even justify each other in a deeply harmful way. But I'm sure you're about to share another example.
I wanted to say the even greater shock was the election of Trump in America, which was bad enough, but then that after 4 years of Trump being president, more than 70 million Americans would still want to have him again. So half of the population thinks that this is a person not only that should govern them, but also that apparently they feel someone whose actions and attitudes one should emulate. And that is what I meant earlier with the lack of decency. That is not, you have a being like Donald Trump admired by 70 million Americans. And he's the opposite of decency, right? He's pure nastiness. And that nastiness is being not only tolerated, but admired and approved of. And he's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, it's not just him. There are so many who are like him. And then the latest is, of course, the war in Ukraine and Putin suddenly deciding to attack Ukraine and all those lives lost, all those people killed. It defies any reason. It makes no sense whatsoever. It doesn't help anyone. So it's not only that people are irrational and they do things that do not quite make sense. They seem to positively delight in destruction and chaos. So that is what I meant when I said I'm a bit disillusioned. I assumed somehow that people are reasonable and willing to understand and willing to find a compromise, willing to get along with each other. But the fact is, we are a horrible species. I mean, we do things just for the sake of destruction and chaos. So vision of a better future, I don't know. Become different, but I don't see it happening. And I only see it getting worse and worse. So I'm quite pessimistic at the moment.
It's tricky, isn't it? And we're a deeply bizarre species because we have so much capacity for good, for compassion, for extending our moral scope of consideration, for using our technology and power for positive ends, often regardless of whether we'll see any direct benefit ourselves. But at the same time, we have all of the dark sides too. We have aggression and a temptation to might makes right and a willingness to warp our beliefs to support our ethics, and patterns of indoctrination that are ongoing around the world that takes in very dark directions. So yeah, it's tricky to know how to think about how that will play out, but much to fight for. And I guess it links back to our earlier conversation in that I do think philosophy can play an important role in trying to nudge us towards a better future, but it can't be disconnected. It has to be plugged into a realistic understanding of human psychology and social norms and political will if it's actually going to have an impact in the world and get out of academia. And I think it can and it does have that impact, even if it's not, you know, often on the headlines. It's often does infuse and nudge culture and societies in better directions. So let's see if it can continue to play that role. Well, it's been absolutely fascinating to talk to you. Sorry for taking up so much of your time, but thank you for sharing your journey.
Thank you.
Yeah, if we haven't answered what matters, who matters, what's real, and how to make a better future, we've asked some good questions, at least given some people some guides for navigation, hopefully. What's the best way of people following you and reading your work and looking out for your new book? Where would you point people?
Much of the stuff is on Academia, the website. So most of my papers are available there. And of course, there are various books that you can buy. I'm sure they're also available in the United States. So.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Well, I'll include some links in the show notes so people can click through and read some more of your work. But it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for your time today. And thank you for being a guest on Sentientist Conversations, Michael.
Thank you very much, Jamie.
Take care.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?